We had masses of audience of white people who wanted to see what this crazy set of people were up to. But the joy of it was, you know, the last night at the Bloomsbury, the audience was 95% black.
And did she believe that the profession was heading in the right direction later in life when she saw the changes that were happening?
Yes, indeed, she did. She saw the changes and she said, I hope it's not just a flash in the pan.
I go down to the National Theatre and I see written by Kwame, I see written by Roy Williams, and I think, yes, there has been a development in British theatre, in black British theatre, and it happened because we're here.
Yvonne Brewster, who's died aged 87. Now, in 1973, an Irish housewife called Mary May McGee became a leading figure in the fight for women's reproductive rights. Under the powerful influence of the Catholic Church, contraception was banned by law in Ireland at the time. But May and her husband Shay brought a landmark court case which changed that. The Irish Times political correspondent Ellen Coyne has been telling me May's story.
Ireland at the time was profoundly, devoutly Catholic, and there effectively was a ban on the importation, sale or advertisement of contraception, which is very much in line with the Catholic Church's teaching at the time. And May and Shay went on to have four children in three difficult pregnancies in just 3 years, which obviously included a set of twins. And May became so ill and so sick from each of those pregnancies, so much so that Shay thought at one point he was going to be a widowed father of four. And the family started to get very concerned and very worried about the effect that a future pregnancy could have on May McGee. She was only in her 20s at the time, and they started to wonder if maybe it might be a time for the family to consider some form of contraception or some sort of more organised family planning.
And they saw a particular doctor, didn't they?
Yes. So by chance, their local GP was a man called Dr. James Loughran, and he just happened to be one of the founders of the Irish Family Planning Association, which was pro-reproductive rights group, which still exists in Dublin today. And he told May that because of her underlying health conditions and the high-risk pregnancies, that it wasn't really appropriate for her to go on the pill. In order to protect her life and her health, her doctor told her that she would need a diaphragm, which required the importation of a spermicide jelly from the UK.
I got scared of having more babies, so I found out about the coil. I had to have the spermicide cream, so I had to send away for it because we couldn't get here in Ireland. It was stopped. So you could say that was the start of my deciding to do something about the problem.
They promptly ordered it with the backing of Dr. Loughran, and it was swiftly seized by the Irish Revenue and Customs on the grounds that importing any form of contraception was against the Irish law at the time.
So did May decide then to challenge that ruling and to challenge it in the courts?
Yes, I mean, this was an ordinary Irish housewife and her fisherman husband. She wasn't a feminist campaigner, but they decided to go ahead with a High Court case in 1972, which was defeated, which actually only made May even more determined. It kind of strengthened her resolve. And they decided that they were going to take a case to the Irish Supreme Court to argue that under Article 40 and Article 41 of the Irish Constitution, they had a right to privacy. It's worth saying at the time, in the early 1970s, there was a vicious debate going on in this country about contraception. The public really backed her, and they felt that this was a housewife who was taking on all the might of the Irish Catholic Church and the Irish state.
So they did win the case.
Yes, they did. And it became one of the most important Supreme Court judgments in the history of Ireland because it proved that the Constitution included inalienable rights to privacy, which is really interesting because for so long in this country, the Constitution was often used as a way to deny rights. In the 1980s, it would be used to impose a constitutional ban on abortion, divorce, marriage equality. But May McGee's case had actually been the basis of proving that women, in particular, did have some inalienable constitutional rights.
And what was the reaction when May and her husband won that court case? What happened to them when they went to church, for example?
So the week after they won their court case, they were at the 10 o'clock mass here in Skerries, and they were basically denounced from the altar. The priest stood up and mentioned people in this town who had brought it into disrepute. It was very clearly a reference to the two of them, and they got up and walked out.
And I wondered how she coped with being such a high-profile figure.
The thing about Mae McGee is that she was such a funny person. The following decade, in the early 1980s, Mae would actually go on to have two more children. Over the following decades, you know, she really kept her role in Ireland's feminist movement kind of quiet, so much so that two of her twin daughters actually were sent home one day by their teacher, who told them to ask their mom about the role that she'd played in women's rights. They didn't know what the teacher was talking about, and it was only when they asked their mother, Mae, that she finally revealed that, yes, she had had a bit of a run-in with the government.
Helen Coyne on Mary Mae McGee, who's died aged 81. This week, last words also go to the singer Donna Jean Godshaw, who was best known as a vocalist with the Grateful Dead in the 1970s. She also sang backing vocals on big hits like When a Man Loves a Woman by Percy Sledge and Suspicious Minds by Elvis Presley. Elvis, backed by Donna Jean Godshaw, who's died aged 78. And if you know of someone who's died recently who had an interesting or unique life, please send us an email with some information about them to lastword@bbc.co.uk. Now, the pioneering film director Peter Watkins, who's died aged 90, was a committed pacifist. In the mid-1960s, his film The War Game depicted the devastating consequences of a nuclear attack on the UK. He used amateur performers to achieve a naturalistic documentary style.
9:16 a.m. A single megaton nuclear missile overshoots Manston Airfield in Kent and airbursts.
The film was initially banned by the BBC and only shown on TV many years later. Peter's son, Gerard Watkins.
The War Game is Peter's attempt to try and warn people about what was going on with the nuclear arms race. And instead of just to have it explained, it was going through this process of trying to make you feel what the disaster would actually be like if there was a nuclear strike. So he wanted it to burn, basically. He wanted what you were looking at to be completely incandescent of what the truth of that bomb would be about.
And the BBC, when they looked at it, decided that they couldn't screen it because it was too horrifying. Why was it so horrifying?
It was horrifying because it was telling the truth. It's as simple as that. Everything was really researched based on what happened in Hiroshima, in Nagasaki.
We went into a great deal of calculation as to the country's recovery potential. Civil Defence Corps figures. And when you do these maths and lay on Britain a medium, not heavy, a medium nuclear attack, the maths give you your answer.
The BBC was under pressure from the government, and the BBC had always denied that they actually had pressure from the British government at the time to censor the film and decide not to show it. And that actually happened because they didn't want anyone to be discussing about the nuclear arms race. They didn't want people to know that this would actually be happening to them.
What was your father's reaction when the BBC refused to show the film?
He was appalled. He was really very hurt at the time. He was hurt until the end, you know. He never had a formal apology because what they were doing at the time with the film, they were also saying that it was not only too horrific, it was also artistically not of no value.
Well, that was completely disproved, wasn't it? Because it was shown in some cinemas and then it went on to win an Oscar.
Yeah, absolutely. And it became cult throughout the world. You know, people have recognized that this was work of genius because what my father was doing in filming had just never been done before. I mean, I don't think that many film directors can actually claim having invented some kind of ways of communicating with people what film might be about.
Wednesday, April 16th, 1746.
For the BBC, he made this film Culloden, about the famous battle, of course, but treated in a very contemporary way, as if there were camera crews reporting from the battle.
Exactly. And he was really into having that history of the battle and what happened with the actors speaking live into the camera. It was as if we were participating in that actual battle. And that, of course, had absolutely never been done before.
You must understand, without putting too fine a point on it, that the army here is in a total shambles.
I've got half my company missing. I just can't find them. They've gone off somewhere to sleep.
Peter moved to Scandinavia and then to the United States. He carried on making ambitious and sometimes controversial films. They included a 14-and-a-half-hour documentary called The Journey, which updated much of the information in the war game and took viewers on a global exploration of what he saw as media manipulation. And perhaps more conventionally, a film about the painter Edvard Munch.
That was his most critical praised film and one of my personal favorites. It's outstandingly beautiful. No biopic looks like Edvard Munch. It's recognized by many as one of the best films ever made about a painter.
Your father must have had the most extraordinary imagination. I wonder what he was like to live with.
Most of the time, you know, I was raised in France by my mother, and I saw him quite a bit, and he'd send us these tapes so we'd always be in contact with him.
Well, audio recordings of him?
Yeah, exactly.
And did you send voice notes back?
Yeah, of course. I bought a tape recorder when I was 12 or with my pocket money, and I was able to send the things back. But yeah, he was a complicated man, of course. He had a great, great sense of humor. Now, that's something that a lot of people wouldn't imagine. He was... could also be very quite hilarious and an amazing sense of humor. But he was tormented by his anxiety to be able to go on saying things. I mean, it's someone who has such a deep message, and that he would always want all the messages of his films to go out right. And he would even criticize his own films, thinking that they were too manipulative.
Gerard Watkins on his father, Peter Watkins, who's died aged 90. This week you also heard last words on the campaigner Mary May McGee, the theatre director Yvonne Brewster, and the US politician Dick Cheney. Don't forget there are hundreds of other fascinating life stories in the Last Word archive on BBC Sounds.
Last Word was presented by Matthew Bannister. It was produced by Gareth Nelson Davis, and the assistant producer was Catherine Powell. It was a BBC Audio Wales production for Radio 4. Now, what does the weather have in store for us? Here's the man who can tell us. It's Simon King.
Good morning, Alan. Good morning, everybody. Yeah, quite a messy picture weather-wise, not only today, but actually through this week. We're going to see spells of rain coming in from the southwest. Quite an unsettled week to come, really. Some drier, some brighter spells between the areas of rain. So for Wales and southwest England today, well, we've got some clear skies through this morning, a bit of sunshine around, but cloud and an area of thunderous showers currently starting to move its way into the Isles of Scilly. The far west of Cornwall will move its way north and eastward to all parts by lunchtime. But then later this afternoon, the showers will become a bit more scattered, and there'll be some sunny spells returning in southwest England, maximum temperatures of 9 to 12 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, pretty cloudy this morning with some rain, especially in eastern areas. Now, much of the rain will clear away, and then there'll be some limited brightness through this afternoon, but more showers, which could turn a bit thundery, will start to move in with temperatures of 12 to 14 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, after a cloudy start with some patchy rain across eastern areas, which will continue to clear away, there'll be some sunny spells developing. But later today in northwest England, some showers will move in from the southwest and temperatures of 11 to 14 Celsius. For Northern Ireland today, some rain is likely at times, especially across northern parts of Northern Ireland. But for southern areas, that's where we're more likely to get some sunny spells, especially this afternoon, temperatures of 9 or 10 Celsius. And across Scotland today, quite a chilly start, actually, especially across northern Scotland, where we've got some clear skies. Rain, though, for elsewhere, and at the moment, really quite heavy across the south. This heavier rain is going to spread north and westward through the day, and then there'll be some brighter spells, some sunshine across eastern areas, maximum temperatures of 9 to 12 Celsius.
Thank you, Simon. This is BBC Radio 4, where now it's time for the shipping bulletin issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0505, today Monday the 10th of November. There are warnings of gales in